Welcome back again to MadQuaker.com. This is podcast number 39, and today is Friday, October 21st, 2011. Today I have should be a brief podcast for you. It shouldn't take very long. There's a sort of a viral video going on out there that's just really become a darling of the left. The progressives and the left-end people are really going nuts over this video. It's of a person named Elizabeth Warren, and apparently she's running for some kind of office. I don't know. Massachusetts Senate. She's your typical leftist. I don't know if she's currently seated and she's trying to maintain her position, or if she is trying to obtain the Senate seat. But it almost doesn't matter, and I don't really care. I don't want to know. You know, all those people are filthy and dirty, and I don't want to deal. I don't want any more knowledge of them than I have to. You know, it's like Bonnie and Clyde. At least Clyde Barrow? That's why I'm confusing the words. Okay, let's try a whole different thief altogether. Let's say at least Jesse James was interesting. You know, so if I wanted to learn something about an interesting thief, I would want to learn about Jesse James. I wouldn't want to learn about Elizabeth Warren or any other person who happens to be in the Senate of the United States or any other politician in any country, really. I mean, how interesting could they be, especially considering how interesting a thief like, Cole Younger was. So if I'm going to waste my time learning about thieves, it's not going to be one of those boring politicians. It's going to be an honest thief. Okay, so I want to go over some points that Elizabeth Warren makes in her video. This thing, the left is really loving this, and they're just jumping all over it, spreading it around on Facebook and stuff. So she does an intro. I'm going to play part of it for you. Let me clarify this. I'm not going to link to her site. I'm not going to link to her site either. I'm not going to link to the video because the same reason that I gave for not linking to the video about the cartoon with how the state started, I'm not going to link to it because I don't want badquaker.com associated with these really bad YouTube videos. Now, I will provide a link. Bob Murphy over at the Mises.org did a good little critique of Elizabeth Warren's YouTube video. And so I'll provide a link in the page to Bob Murphy's dissecting her argument. And you should probably check out Bob's statement because, you know, he's smart and he's educated and he's like a really, really smart person. And I'm not. So I'm just looking at it from, you know, a guy who is just a regular guy. And Bob Murphy is looking at it from an educated point of view. So Bob has probably a much better take than me. And I have a, you know, digging in the ditches kind of a take. But stick with me. I'm gonna play some of her parts here. Well, I guess I'll end up playing the whole thing. It's only 2 minutes and 6 seconds long. And the first 8 seconds or so is not really part of the video. So I'll play part of it, and then I'll critique part of it. So let's go ahead and I'll play a little bit here. Oh, let's find out where I'm starting and stopping for. Okay, so I guess the first part is an attack on George W. Bush. So you justify yourself by attacking someone who has nothing to do with the argument. But let's start with that.
My favorite part of looking at this whole, we got this whole $1 trillion on tax cuts for the rich under George Bush. We got into this whole $2 trillion on two wars that we put on a credit card for our children and grandchildren to pay off. And we got into this whole $1 trillion on a Medicare drug program that, A, was not paid for, and B, is 40% more expensive than it needs to be because it was a giveaway to the drug companies. So we just have, I mean, that's just $4 trillion right there. So part of the way you fix this problem is, like, don't do those things.
Okay. I love simplicity. Okay, so she names these things, $1 trillion for this, $2 trillion for that, and $1 trillion for another thing. And she says, she makes an interesting statement, 40% It's 40% too expensive. The Medicare drug program is 40% too expensive. I don't know how she comes up with that particular number. I would say it's 100% too expensive. When a government, any government, takes socialist actions and they rob from one group of people and then they shove money in, I guess it's not, well, it is socialist, but it's fascism because they're taking money from one group of people, shoving it into the pockets of a specified industry, and doing all this through the force of government. Then, yeah, I would say 100% of it is more expensive than it needs to be because none of it should be happening. But anyway, that's beside the point. Really, here's something to think about. She says, so part of the way you fix these is you don't do these things. And then the crowd, yay, yeah, don't do those things. Don't get involved in two unwinnable wars. You shouldn't be taxing... shouldn't be having tax cuts for the rich because there shouldn't be any taxes. Theft is wrong. And you shouldn't have a $1 trillion Medicare drug giveaway program because that's immoral. Again, it's wrong. But here's the funny part. She blames Bush for these things even though it was her party that supported Bush in all those things. It was her party that pushed all those things. It's her party who continues to support those things. So it's like... the Republicans are the bad guys because they have these socialist programs, so we're supposed to elect Democrats who are socialists. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so let's hear the next part. This is about class warfare.
I hear all this, this is class warfare, this is whatever. No, there is nobody in this country who got rich on his own.
Well... there's nobody in this country that got rich on his own. As I break through these and take this apart, I'm going to use some words and phrases that are very specific to what's called rhetoric. If you're presenting an argument, that's rhetoric. So if I'm going to say, you're more successful to fish on a sunny day than a rainy day, if that's my argument, then I would present evidence to support this. I would say this and that, and I would maybe talk about why the fish like these days as opposed to those days and how the rain affects the water in a pond or whatever. So all that together is my rhetoric, and then I would need to draw all that together and then form a conclusion in order to convince someone of my argument. So this is the basic, so I'll be referring to basic parts of rhetoric as I'm showing what it is she's saying. So she says it's not class warfare. There's nobody in this country that got rich on their own. Okay, that's called a straw man argument. No one is holding the position that these rich people are just islands of wealth that formed purely on their own and that nobody had anything to do with them. So that's just a straw man argument. In addition, it's another argument that's involved there that's called a non sequitur. It incorrectly assumes one thing is the cause of another. So, for example, recall the discussion when I was talking about the four achievements of mankind: the hammer, the blade, the lever, and fire. Okay, everything that we have throughout society since then, as far as all technological developments, come to us by way of the hammer, the blade, the lever, and fire. So then, if every other achievement is based on those four achievements, then yes, everything we have in society is based on a building effect that all of us together throughout the ages and all of us together currently are doing and stuff that we have done. But this doesn't justify funding the government and the government's ever-expanding budget. Assuming the successes of individuals or of the society as a whole are not the successes of the government. So because one person or a group of people or a lot of people are successful in a particular thing, that doesn't justify supporting the government and having the government have an ever-expanding budget to just keep on taxing and spending and taxing and spending. So it's a straw man argument, and it's a non sequitur argument, because it incorrectly assumes that one thing is the cause of the other. The bloated government is not the cause, or not the is not related to necessarily why certain people are rich, although it is, some people are rich because of the bloated government, but she doesn't go in that direction. Okay, let's hear the next part.
Nobody. You built a factory out there, good for you, but I want to be clear. You moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for. You...
Ah. Okay, so she says, you built a factory out there, good for you, but you moved your goods to market on the roads that the rest of us paid for. Okay, we have a few here. The first one is called a sweeping generality. The second one is called a fallacy of composition. In other words, from each to all, or because one is, all are. Okay, I'll break this down a little bit. And then the third is a non sequitur. So she assumes that the factory never paid any taxes prior to the factory builder. Whoever this mysterious factory builder is, he never paid any taxes prior to building his factory. See, she says, you built your factory out there, good for you, but you moved your goods to market on the roads that the rest of us paid for. So she assumes that this guy just came out of nowhere and never paid any taxes the whole first part of his life. Then she assumes that no taxes were paid during the construction of the factory, of the facility. All the trucks that brought stuff in, and none of those trucks were taxed when they were bought or when they were refilled each time or every time tires were put on them, and that the guys driving those trucks were not constantly taxed for every nickel that they earned. These are layers and layers of assumptions that she's putting into this that are just sweeping generalities, that none of these people ever paid any of their taxes. And then she assumes that the goods that get moved from on those roads are being moved without paying taxes. And then she assumes that the roads would not have gotten built without the government and those taxes. So what she's assuming is that because not enough taxes in her mind were paid by this evil factory builder, then not enough taxes were paid in all these other stages along the line. So because evidently she's assuming he didn't pay enough taxes to begin with, then she's assuming that further taxes are not enough all the way down the line. And then she makes the non sequitur leap as to whether or not this roads would get built with or without the government. Of course, I've covered that in the discussion of the building of private highways and the man's name escapes me for the moment, but the originator of the Indianapolis 500 and the businessman that built all the roads and the things like the Lincoln Highway and stuff, all that is just out of the question. We just make the assumption that roads wouldn't get built if there was no government. Okay, so we're going to go to the next section now.
Hired workers, the rest of us paid to educate.
Oh my. Let's back that up one more time.
Educate. You hired workers. The rest of us paid to educate.
Well, that's a massive assumption. That is a huge assumption. You hired workers. The rest of us paid to educate. Now, first off, that makes every single one of the mistakes of the last one that we just took apart. It's a sweeping generality. It's a fallacy of composition, and it's a non sequitur. Sweeping generality, again, she's assuming he didn't pay any taxes prior to this time. She's assuming that one thing is related to the other when there's not necessarily anything connecting the two things together. And she's assuming that the education that the so-called public education actually is useful to the guy in the factory. Well, first off, I would deny that as being even anywhere. That's a deductive fallacy to begin with, that you would learn something in the schools that would actually help you in a factory. Not in my experience, and I've worked in quite a number of factories, and I've been to a lot of schools. Okay, so let's see. So you hired workers, the rest of us paid to educate. That's all the same general sweeping generalities, fallacy of composition, and it is a non sequitur. And I'm looking over my notes to make sure I didn't miss anything in that rant. Yeah, okay. Assumes the factory builder never paid taxes and that the schools are actually useful to the factory owner. Okay, so let's hear the next section. Oh, this is a good one. You are safe because of the police. This is the same argument that, well, without the state, they would break your door down and come in and eat your face off. Oh, okay. Let's hear her take on this one. Shriek at us, lady.
You were safe in your factory because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for.
Okay. So it is, again, a sweeping generality, assuming that no taxes have ever been paid before by this guy. He just mysteriously showed up with a factory. He didn't pay taxes prior to that time to make enough money to have the money to build a factory. So, you know, evidently he's just totally just a leech on society all the way up to the point where he got the factory built. So again, we have sweeping generalities, fallacy of composition, and a non sequitur. And that's not even addressing, okay, well, we'll address that again in a minute, but because she brings back up this fear factor thing that to throw back on our face. But again, she's assuming that somehow that this guy, whoever this factory builder is, has never paid any taxes before, and she just follows the same ridiculous train of thought in this. Okay, we're going to go to the next one now. Oh, here she goes. More fear-mongering. So let's hear the rest of the fear-mongering.
You didn't have to worry that marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory and hire...
Oh, no. Oh, no, not the marauding bands. Oh, save us from the marauding bands. You know, that's a problem whenever you build a factory. As soon as you turn around, the marauding bands show up, and they take everything out of your factory. I hate it when that happens. This is called hyperboil. Hyperboil is when you use vast exaggerations as a rhetorical device. So for instance, it's fear-mongering. That's all it is. So, in other words, if I was let's say you're growing apple trees, and I am a chemical salesman, and I want to sell you spray so that your apple trees do not get infected with worms and destroy your apple crop, I would come to you and I would say, if I were an honest chemical salesman trying to sell my product, I would come to you and I would say, Mr. Smith, I would like to sell you some chemicals for your apple trees so that you can kill the worms before they are able to destroy your apple harvest. Now, that would be a legitimate way for me to sell my chemicals to Mr. Smith, the apple farmer. On the other hand, if I were going to use hyperboil to sell my chemicals to Mr. Smith, the apple farmer, I could come to him and I could say something like, Mr. Smith, if you don't buy this chemical from me, raiding worm marauders will come and they'll eat everything within your whole property. They'll tear your house down. They'll consume your children. They'll burn down your barn. See, that would be hyperboil. That would be exaggerations as a rhetorical device. And it would be fear-mongering. And that's what she's doing. She's just fear-mongering. When you fear-monger, you don't actually require any evidence for your fear-monger. You could say things like, if we don't search old ladies at the airport, then horrible, evil Muslim terrorists will come from the Middle East and kill your children. You know, that's hyperboil. That's presenting a ridiculous fear-based argument without any actual substance behind the argument. Okay, so let's hear the rest of it here.
Someone to protect against this because of the work the rest of us did. Now look, you built a factory and it turned into something terrific or a great idea. God bless. Keep a big hunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract is you take a hunk of that and pay forward for the next kid who comes along.
Yay for the next... Oh, it's for the children. Think of the children. Oh. Boy, they love to bring out the kids and beat us with them, don't they? Okay, so she says, you did this. Good for you. Keep a big chunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract, blah, 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 pay forward for the next kid who comes along. Okay, so what we have here is called an irrelevant conclusion. It's unsupported by the rhetoric provided. And then next she has, she affirms the consequent. She draws a conclusion from premises that do not support that conclusion. In other words, let me think of an example real quick. I saw Bill with a hat yesterday right before he robbed the liquor store. Therefore, hats cause people to rob liquor stores. Or, therefore, robbers wear hats. See, you're drawing a conclusion based on something that doesn't support that conclusion. This is a good... This final part that she throws out here, Bob Murphy has a really good thing that he says about it. He goes... I'm going to quote Bob Murphy here. He goes, underlying social contract? Well, it's very convenient for her to discuss this contract, which none of us has ever seen, but apparently she can interpret. So, yeah, so there's this supposedly, she says, you keep a big chunk of it, but part of the underlying social contract is that you have to pay it forward for the next kid who comes along. Where is this social contract? What page on the social contract can I look this part up? Who exactly signed this social contract? What kind of paper was it written on? Who is the witnesses? Because, see, for a contract to actually be a contract and not just the imagination of a twisted mind, it actually has to have some kind of substance. So, for instance, if I just show up at Bob's apple farm again, we're going to go back to Mr. Smith's apple farm, and I say, hey, Bob, I got a contract with you to eat all your apples. And he's like, where did this contract come from? I don't remember signing that contract. No, it's a contract. Well, if you don't have some substance to base this social contract on, then how can you assume there is a social contract? Now, let me look at my notes here real quick. Oh, this is another interesting thing. So she basically infers here that George W. Bush violated the social contract with him setting up these evil rich people to have their tax cuts. But how is it that we can assume that George W. Bush's tax cuts were a violation of this social contract when Obama's raising taxes on the rich, robbing them more, is okay in the social contract? What page of the social contract can I look that up on so that we can check and make sure that her translation of the social contract is the legitimate one? After all, if we're gonna consider, let's say, the Second Amendment to figure out, did they really mean people can walk around with guns? Well, let's take a look at it and see what the wording says. See, that's how we would settle something about a contract. Of course, the problem there is that that contract, the Constitution, was never signed either. I didn't sign it. I don't know of anybody that signed it. No one's alive who even had anything to do with the acceptance or non-acceptance of it. As a matter of fact, it didn't even get a general vote. I mean, it wasn't even a basic majority that got it through. It was small groups of men got it through, but the majority of the public never even got to read the thing. Of course, that's kind of beside the point, but that's a contract that the whole nation of the United States thinks that our government is based on. And it's not even legitimate. How can a contract, which is not written, it's not on paper, and it seems to be just made up as she goes along to say whatever it is that she wants it to say, how can we accept that as a social contract? That doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, so that's my take on her thing. Again, you know, Bob Murphy does a nice little argument on it, and I'll put a link to his article. And in his article, there's a link to her video if you want to watch it on there. But the main thing is that and I've been kind of throwing this as a theme for a few weeks now, whenever we see these things, don't get caught up in the emotion. like in her case, you think about how she stirs the crowd and her voice rises and she gets everybody all excited about it and she talks down like she's scolding some misbehaving child when she's talking to these evil Republicans. Well, you know, they're thieves, just like she's a thief and just like her group is a thief. Her Democrats are thieves. But as long as they can keep pointing their finger back and forth at each other and have this really exciting rhetoric that they can get all emotional about, then people don't stop and look about the substance and say, is this person really giving me some food for thought, or is this just fluff? Are they just handing me a handful of feathers and saying, here, enjoy your steak? And really, that's all it is. That's the better that we can analyze what they're feeding us, and the more calm we can keep ourselves when they're throwing these things at us, the easier it is to see the flaws in their logic and to see the flaws in their reasoning. Now, here's one other thing I wanted to throw out about this before I wrap it up. How is it that a person is able to throw out such gobbledygook and the crowd just eats it up like that? They just love it. How is that possible? Well, it's the same way if you're talking about George W. Bush back in the back during his years. He was able to throw out ridiculous statements like, the terrorists want to kill us because of our freedom. What? You see, the reason that these people are able to throw out things like this, and without question the general public just gobbles it up, is because they've had over 100 years now that they had started with the youngest of children, and they started indoctrinating and brainwashing them through their government schools. And so they have consistently, for over 100 years now, taught Americans how to not think, how to be led. And as they have done this, they have removed from people the ability to logically deduce what part of an argument is simply false, and what part is fluff, and what part is fear, and what part is not based on reality and not based on logic. And so they're able to use these rhetorical tools to twist the way that we think and cause us to draw the conclusions in our minds that they want us to draw. And then we believe these things. We don't even know why we believe them. We don't realize that we believe these things that they've spoon-fed us like this because we've been taught to believe them. So anyway, and now I want to give you a takeaway from this, because again, I have criticism that I'm not giving people, I'm not giving my listeners a job to do, is to be a part of this. Well, yeah, there is. Here's what you do. Not only for yourself, you teach yourself how to spot these fallacies, but also for younger people and for children especially, or for your friends and your family. Teach them slowly and gently and politely how to be able to spot. You don't have to take a whole thing apart the way I do with her, but when something like this comes up, if you can just pick out one obvious fallacy and just put that one obvious fallacy into perspective, then sometimes that's enough to throw doubt into the minds of a person, and they'll start thinking of stuff on their own. So if you can just bait a person with a single, yeah, except what about this type of a thing? And then, and if you can form it in the form of a question to them, so that you're not just, you know, punching them with an objection. If like in her case, if you're listening through to her thing, and you get to the end and she spouts this nonsense about a social contract, and you just, without attacking the concept of a social contract, you just throw out the thought, I wonder how it is that she knows how to translate this social contract better than, let's say, the factory owner, or better than anybody else. What special ability does she have to understand this social contract that no one else has? And once you lay out a question like that for somebody else to think about, you don't necessarily have to have them answer it. It's just a question. I'm just asking. I was just wondering. And then you have done this in a non-threatening way, so that the person can consider it without being put in a position where you've humiliated them and attacked something they thought was really cool. Okay, well, thanks a lot for listening again. This is kind of a short podcast today, but I just wanted to throw that out and get it out for your consideration. It's just a quick little, I guess this is a quick little review of rhetoric and how to spot some of the fallacies and some of the tricks that people can use in rhetoric to get you to think the way that they want you to think. Thanks very much, folks. Again, we're hoping to this evening for the interview almost said Bob Murphy. Maybe in the future I'm going to get back in touch with Bob Murphy again and see if he can fit us into his schedule. He's a super busy guy, but not Bob Murphy. Robert Higgs, with if everything goes good, I'll be talking to him on the phone later this evening, and we'll have that interview up hopefully this coming week, and I'm very excited about that. Thanks a lot for listening, folks. Check us out at badquaker.com. Thanks.